Hey, everybody. Welcome to the New World Pictures podcast. When Roger Corman passed earlier this month, we knew we wanted to do something special, and we are lucky enough to bring in three special guests who worked and knew Roger. We spoke to Alan Arkish, the co-director of Hollywood Boulevard and director of Rock and Roll High School, and who edited trailers for Roger for many years.
Alan Holzman, who directed Forbidden World.
And Tony Randall, who started out at New World in special effects and became the head of post-production and eventually would direct Hellbound, Hellraiser 2 for the new World once Roger sold the company. They had some great stories and some great things to say about Roger, and here we are talking to them.
Did you see Corman movies when you were growing up?
Well, I grew up, my father's bakery was right across the street from Barry Levinson's diner. So the movie theater where Mickey Rourke had the popcorn, that was the Crest Theater, and that's where I always went. And I saw every Roger Corman movie at that time.
Wow.
Saturday we went there. You know, we stopped at the bakery, got cookies, and went in. But we never saw it from the beginning. It was always more interesting to come in midway and try to guess the story. And then you stay for the next thing to see if you were right.
Just to see that you'd start in the, yeah, you'd watch yeah. a little bit
it,
of the next
it made
show.
It much more interesting, you know?
Yeah, sure. Sure.
Yes, I did. Yeah, I've answered the question.
Yeah. Yes, please, Tony.
Yes, I did. But I went to high school very near his office. I went to University High School in Westwood. Mm. His office was right there. And when I was in school, I remember people wandering around campus with clipboards asking, would you go see this movie? Would you go see this movie? Their titles. So my exposure to the New World was before I ever worked there. It was being questioned. And I specifically remember being asked, would I go see a movie called Avalanche?
Ah! I'm sorry. That's what I used to do. That was one of my jobs. Roger would call the editing room as if we were a real, survey department, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, why don't you go down to Hollywood High School? That seemed to be the one he always talked about. And see which title people will go see more. The Submersion of Japan or Tidal Wave.
Yeah, that was the same movie, right?
Yes.
And so much.
Submersion of Japan was the Japanese version, and then Tidal Wave is what it got recut into.
Right.
And he changed the title to Tidal Wave, and then this is terrible. He told us when we cut the trailer to make sure there was no Japanese people in the trailer.
Wow. Yeah.
And we all left, you know, the movie was cut down. They added new scenes with Lauren Green.
Correct, yes.
Lauren Green was the ambassador to the UN, which basically consisted of him at a desk. It was not good. And then, and there was a guy named, was it Ernie Anderson? Martin, anyone ever see a show called The Millionaire?
Sure.
The guy who handed out the checks, who played Michael Anthony, he used to come and do all our voices. And he basically played everyone in the picture that me and Joe did not play.
Wow.
And
Ernie Anderson?
I guess it was Ernie Anderson.
The voice.
I don't know. We used Ernie Anderson and someone else. I thought his name was Martin Miller, but I could be wrong. And we go to the movie opens on Hollywood Boulevard, I think at the Vogue or someplace. And people are coming out of the theater going, don't go in, it sucks. Don't go in, it sucks.
Actually, Alan Arkin.
You mentioned is it Martin Miller? Didn't he direct Street Girls?
I got them all confused. Yes, Martin Miller directed Street. Wow, you remember Street Girls.
Well, that became Angel, which was a big hit during Tony's era.
Okay. The actress in Street Girls was quite good.
The story doesn't actually end there, Alan.
Oh.
Does it? Because I was running post-production for New World under the new regime, and they acquired Godzilla 1985. And the head of marketing said, you know, when Roger owned this company, he acquired this film, The Submergent of Japan, and they got Lauren Green to shoot some footage and Americanize it. So can you go and get Lauren Green and Americanize it? Not, he didn't know that this had been done before with,
Oh my God.
right. So we actually got Raymond Burr and Americanized it. But that it was a lead
That's
on
amazing.
exactly what you had just talked about.
Well, there's one point in poor Lauren Green's talking, and he had this line that he couldn't get. And it was the world's worst line of dialogue. Oh, when that tidal wave hit, millions will die. And he kept, and finally he gets it, and he just goes like this, right? So Joe and I take that shot and shake the frame like he's been hit with a tidal wave.
When that wave hits, 80 million people will be wiped out.
Tidal Wave, rated PG.
Now, did Alan, when you grew up, did you see a bunch of Roger Corman movies when you were
No,
growing
I
up?
didn't. The Lee Theater in Fort Lee didn't really run them. I saw some William Castle movies, and I think the first Corman movie I saw was The Trip.
I'm Peter Fonda. We've just finished making a movie dealing with the most talked about subject of the day, LSD.
That's my favorite. That's what I thought. That was a brilliant, brilliant movie.
And then my second one, when I was at NYU, we had only three classrooms. The school, Tisch didn't exist. We were just three or four classrooms. And we went on strike for more equipment. We only had one camera that could do sound. And we went on strike. And of course, when you go on strike in those days, you have a sit-in, you take over the floor, and you smoke pot all night. And we basically watched movies nonstop all night. And around 4 in the morning, we kind of ran out of movies. And I was told to go. So I went to my friend, John Davison, who was the head of post at Corman and produced Airplane and lots of others and got me my job. He lived on St. Mark's Place. So I went cross town to St. Mark's Place. His apartment was full of films. That was the basis of the film collection that he had with Joe Dante. And I said, John, I woke him up and he said, how's the strike going? I says, we've run out of movies. He says, well, what's it like down there? I says, well, everyone's really stoned and we need something. For 5 in the morning, and he goes, oh, they'll love this. And he handed me Little Shop of Horrors. And that's what we watched at 5 in the morning. And it went over a ton. It was enough. And we followed that up with a John Ford movie. And I know it was Ford because when we marched on the dean's office, we sang Shall We Gather at the River.
So I have a quick story about Roger and making of the trip, because he felt that he had never done acid before, and he felt that he should do acid to understand the movie. And so he went to Griffith Park with Frances Dohle, Peter Fonda, Jack Nicholson, and Robert Towne, and they all took acid, and then they couldn't find Roger. And they looked all over for him, and they found him face down in mud. And they turned him over, and he said, "I'm sure glad I made my millions before this."
It was Francis's job to write down everything he said. And I guess, you know, I've read quotes later that he said, I see ships, they're made out of crystal. So I think that the Doors was playing on somebody's, you know, portable radio. And the lines, among the lines that happened that day that are in the picture, he is like, there's a line in the picture which makes me and Joe laugh every time. Someone holds up an orange and he goes, oh, feel the energy. That always makes you laugh. And then there's a scene where Peter Fonda's naked And he runs out on the balcony, and of all the people to be your guide, it's Bruce Dern. And Bruce Dern is trying to make him feel better. And he says, and Peter Fonda freaking out. And Bruce Dern says, come inside, come into the living room, come into the living room. And Peter Fonda says, the living room, the living room. Dern laughs, and Fonda goes, what's so funny? He says, the way you said living room. And Fonda says, you're weird, man. And goes, that was, we watched that movie a lot. That movie can be double billed with almost anything.
Now, do you guys, well, Tony, let's start with you, but do you guys all remember the first time that you met Roger Corman?
Yes. I was working downstairs in the mailroom, and I was walking, there was a stairway in his building in Brentwood, and I was walking up and he was walking down, and I introduced myself. And he was so gracious and welcoming, and it was like the greatest day of my life. And that began a long association.
Sure, because you would stay with New World, you'd start working in special effects, you started eventually heading up, you were the head of post-production, especially when he was doing Millennium and sold New World.
Yeah, I was head of post-production. I was the last head of post-production of New World and the first head of post-production of New Horizons Concord. It was called Millennium, I guess.
And where was your editing rooms?
It was at the Lumberyard in Venice.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So you had, Alan, you had left by the time they built the Lumberyard, correct?
Right. My last film that I cut the, I've done Rock and Roll High School, and I cut the trailer for Lady in Red. So it's like June of 79. So our editing rooms were in Hollywood. There's a video out of me and Joe going to all those editing rooms, the two of them, one on Cole and one on El Centro. And El Centro was the one, because by then the place was booming. So El Centro was the one where they cut Rock and Roll High School and Piranha and Eat My Dust and Grand Theft Auto. So we had a lot of people going in and out of that. And that was the, and we used to go around corner to this bar when we finished for the day and so forth. But I first met Roger, Alan, because of your movie. Because one of the first trailers that Joe was cutting when I joined New World was Candy Stripe Nurses.
And which doing, Alan Holzman edited.
Right.
And then directed, right?
Alan Hollow.
Alan Hollow. I'm sorry.
Another Alan. Okay. But only one Alan.
All right. So at that time, we were working on three trailers. Candy Stripe Nurses. Cage Heat, Women of Flesh Behind Bars of Steel, and of course that driving class that Cries and Whispers. And Roger came down to the editing room and we showed him the trailer for Candy Stripe Nurses. And what that meant was, okay, so when Alan would cut the movie, anyone would cut the pictures, there was no color dailies. Roger would have the dailies printed in low-con black and white. And so you didn't know what any of the shots really, the exposures or anything. And then we would take that and dupe it. Not the whole picture, but the sections we wanted. So now we're into a lot more contrast. And we would cut that, and then we'd compose the narration, you know. And so when Roger or anyone came by, we would run the film and say the narration out loud. And the film was only one track. And, you know, there isn't an executive in Hollywood who can bear to watch anything without 10 tracks working. You know, and Roger would sit there and he'd cut from effects to dialogue and we'd be saying the lines and he would give you really good notes, you know. Despite how insanely primitive that was. I think we got a two-headed moviola to do Rock and Roll High School. We rented one, you know, because we had to be able to run the music and the dialogue at the same time.
Wow. And well, Alan,
you and Joe were working in kind of a back room.
Yes.
And it was really inspiring because you guys went in those days, you know, for the soundtrack, you get Phil from the lab, which was 35 millimeter films, prints of films that didn't turn out quite right. And so they would be sold for a penny a foot or something. And so Roger bought those, but sometimes you would get classic movies in.
Right.
Real some classic films. And so that was dubbed the Arkish Dante, Alan Arkish, Joe Dante Memorial Library. But they had a reel of Snow White there, and they had a reel, this is where I learned everything from Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch. And it actually had the bridge explosion sequence. And I studied that.
Right.
And I saw that there were like four frames of clear with all the explosions. And I thought, well, I can do that. I can take a gunshot and put in clear, or an explosion and put in clear and make it bigger. And I did that for everything. It was really transforming.
Now, Alan, do you remember when you first met, you were brought into Candy Stripe Nurses to edit by Julie Corman, but yes. Do you remember when you first met Roger?
It was at the first screening we had in the, he had, you know, Noel Nosek's dad had a screening room on Sunset, and it was the oldest screen, oldest, smallest screening room in the world. And, and it was right next to Dick Clark Studios, mm-hmm. and there, and I couldn't find it when I first went there. And my assistant gave me the address with the name, and you know, I stuttered quite a bit then. And
yeah, I had to go behind.
Looking around, and this guy comes up to me, and it's actually Dick Clark. And, wow. And I say, "Do you know where Nosek is?" And he went like this.
It was right next to the Cock and Bull.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
It was a bar restaurant that was owned by Jack Webb.
So Roger gave notes the first time, and you know, he sat in the back of the theater that sat maybe 12 people or 16 people, right. And he had a yellow notepad, and he would always write carefully, so he would look down at what he was writing. He would miss part of the films, but ultimately later I'd see, he would see the movie four times, and by then he would always see everything. But most of his notes were like, take four frames off the beginning of the shot, take four frames off the end of this shot. And
yeah,
really learned pace with him, you know. Yeah. That was the most important thing with him.
And yes, he was so specific with the notes that after, I mean, Joe and I were there for 6 years. So after a certain amount of time, and when he would come to the editing room, we actually understood his metabolic sense of editing. By that, I mean, everybody has a different rhythm, right? Every sure. filmmaker, based on their heartbeat, based on their attention span. And we found that Roger divided things by four frames. That's four frames you could see. Eight frames, you could actually tell what it was, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so we were always head extending and tail extending shots. And if we didn't agree with some cut that Roger wanted to, he always liked to take like a motorcycle jumping across a canyon and extend it, use like six angles, but it would always look, he thought it looked fine. We always thought it looked phony. So he would go, oh, send that, and you know, and double cut that. So what we would do when he was on the phone and we were making, we would just splice the film and put it back together again. And we could hear the splices go through. Oh, very good. See?
Now, Tony, when you were editing for with Corman, you did a lot of special effects, but you were head of that. Was he still doing black and white when you were?
Oh, well, I worked in visual effects early on, and then I was editing.
Right.
We did not get black and white dailies then, but what we did, because it was trailers, we would duplicate. There was a place called Conrad Film on Santa Monica that used to do really cheap duplications on this type of film stock that you could not destroy. So it was had a double advantage. And that's how we used to do it. We used to just get selected scenes. Actually, by that time, I think it might have been cheaper. We were probably duplicating the whole film, now that I think about it. But it was black
Yeah,
and white.
John Davison wouldn't let us duplicate the whole film. So we had to go borrow the reels. We'd watch it with Roger at Nosix. And let me tell you, the number of films we saw crash and burn at Nosix. So we'd watch the film with them. And then when everyone left after Roger gave us notes, we would sit with Roger and talk about what it was he wanted to sell and what we thought worked and didn't. And then we would borrow the reels out of order because you can't interrupt the editing process. And we'd run the reels. And if a section was something we wanted to use in the trailer, we would run a piece of tape across it and we would have the counter going. So we'd write down the footages and we'd do the same thing with the sound. And I think we brought it to the same place you did to do the black and white dupes, except we called it the dupeteria. We go to dupeteria for that. We go to writer sound for the sound. It would come back, and it was my job to sync it up, and then we'd have it coded so that we could figure out what went with which. And then I broke it down into scenes, and we never really... We didn't do like a professional editor like Alan, you know. We didn't save the trims the same way. We just hung everything in the bins because we had to cut the trailers in a couple of days, you know. Mm-hmm. So we cut a trailer and two
you,
TV.
You wouldn't spots. Just put the in the bins. You put them over your neck. You tape
yes.
them to the walls.
Yeah, they were everywhere.
Those are the special ones.
Yes. And Joe would dive into the bin and come up with, that's what I'm looking for.
But it's an amazing skill to edit with a dupe and a grease pencil and tape and
yes.
and really understand what you're doing and being able to evaluate it. And certainly I learned that from Roger. And,
yes.
you know, and like you said, no executive in the world today can watch a film without a mixed temp track fully filled effects. So they think there's
yeah.
something. They can't evaluate.
Yeah.
They don't know. They can't do it.
Hmm.
Well, Roger was a filmmaker. You know, he could understand everything. He understood every. And the thing that was so great is that everyone admired him as a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And so we could put up with all his fierceness as a producer and cheapness because we knew he made great movies. And
yes.
we all loved him for that.
He was cheap, but I've come to describe it differently now. I think he was very disciplined.
Yes.
I because he had a, it was a business. He never lost sight of the fact. He would never look at something and say, oh gosh, if we put $10,000 more, it would be so much better. Never. And that's discipline. And that's just knowing your business. And that's how.
Well, he learned that the hard way because his last movies like Gas and The Trip, he was trying to be a movie maker, a filmmaker, and it failed. They were commercial yeah. flops, and it really hurt him. So he was determined not to fail again.
Mm.
Producer. Plus, he had to stay alive. So,
right.
You know, he had to pay the bills.
Yeah.
But why do you guys think that he never directed? I mean, he directed again in 1990, he did Frankenstein Unbound, but like...
Well, he did 55 movies as the director.
Yeah, you can get... I understand completely. I got burnt out also, you know. But I think in Roger's case, he had ideas about expanding and having his own company. And, you know, nothing will drive you out of being a director quicker than stupid notes. And he was getting a lot of bad notes from AIP.
Right. Right.
And that's why he formed New World, you know, and whatever Roger's notes were, they were focused on his taste. And then he would give you a reason. And if it was your film, he would explain to you what you did wrong and what movie you should watch to correct it.
Mm-hmm.
So you're shooting a 3 days, 27 pages of action. And he's telling you, you should study the films of David Lean. You know, and you go, Lawrence of Arabia, David Lee? Yes. Was like, okay, you know, and he would say, you need more foreground, midground, than background.
Yeah.
Well, when I got my directing break, you know, he said he was going to give me the same lecture as he gave you and Joe Jonathan Demme, et cetera. And one of those was, you know, to find, when you come to a set, find the widest angle and shoot that. And then he gave the example that whenever he was doing the Poe movie, he would walk around with the candelabra and put it in the foreground.
Right. Yes, the foreground.
And then his other note was, as soon as you see a take you like, do not ask the cameraman if he liked it. You know, announce the next shot where the camera's going to go. And he said, if you stick around asking if they like it, you're going to waste 5 minutes per shot. That's an hour per day, et cetera.
That's exactly it, Alan. Yes. Do never congratulate the crew. I know you'll be surprised that it worked. But if you congratulate the crew, that's 30 seconds of setup. And by the end of the day, you've lost a half hour.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
And the foreground thing. This is so bizarre. Okay, so there was a picture called Death Sport, which was a terrible movie, and Roger wanted me to come in.
Well, we liked it. It has its moments. It has its moments. There's a lot of wonderful motorcycle crashes.
Yes, thank you. So I have to go and I have to fix this movie. In exchange, I will get to do my High School Musical. That's the deal. And so I have to rewrite it, re-edit it, and go out and shoot for like a week of stuff on it. And he wants us to just take all the motorcycles and blow them up, basically was the plot at that point. And please, Alan, figure out what the Death Sport is. I mean, it was called Death Sport. No one can figure it out. So you know the movie, remember there's a motorcycle chase through these concrete narrow hallways.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now that's a Nike missile base that's been abandoned in San Pedro.
Yep.
So I go down there and I take pictures of it with a Polaroid, you know, and I come back and Roger says, "Whoa, did you find the location?" I said, "Yes." He says, "Let me see." So Roger and I are sitting on the floor by his coffee table, laying out all these, you know, Polaroids. And he says, "Well, I think you can really do a great chase here." I said, "Well, the problem is, Roger, is that we don't have more than 50 yards and it's just this kind of a U, you know, so it's not like you can really do a long chase." And I swear, he looks at me and he says, "Alan, have you ever seen Eisenstein's Ivan the Terrible?" And I said something like, because I was being a jerk, "Part one or part two?" part one, part two is in color. And he explained what he meant, which is exactly what you're saying, Alan. He said, "Shoot the motorcycles going by. I'll give you three cameras. Then put a cutting piece to make it look like it's a different run of this," you know? "And let them go by, and then set the cutting piece on fire." And that's what we did. You know?
Wow. Wow. And it's effective. Man, it's
working. In a manner of speaking.
You actually remind me of a great story that Roger told about Death Race.
Ah.
We were at Comic-Con, and Mary Warnoff was going on about how Roger was never around on the set when they were shooting. And Roger raised his hand like this, and he got called on. And he said, "That's because I was doing all the driving work for the second takes, because the stuntman wanted extra money. So I got into the car and did them myself."
on Grand Theft Auto, we had so many cars. You guys know that picture?
Yep. Okay, and for sure. And you did second unit on it.
Yeah. And so there's this mass chase, you know, across the desert, and there's so many cars that myself and the grip for the second unit came, and I knew him because he worked at the Fillmore East, and so he became a grip out here, and we decided that we would have very specific camera mounts for each of the vehicles. So as soon as you cut to it, you would see some piece of the car and would tell you which vehicle you were, you know. And We designed all this stuff, and we had two Rolls Royces. One was a straight Rolls Royce that I swear to God will never drive it over 30 miles an hour. The other one was a Bentley body with a Rolls Royce grill on a Chevy truck frame with a gigantic Chevy blown engine and a, let's see if I got this right, a rear end axle ratio. I still remember this stuff.
Wow.
So that you could accelerate really fast. Because when you're shooting car stuff, and this is all information I got from Roger. Alan, when you're shooting a car shot and it's coming towards you on a flat area, 14 frames a second, no, 16 frames a second, 14 when it goes away, side to side, you really can't get under 19. I mean, he knew.
Wow.
Wow.
And so wow. For reasons that I can never understand, I decided I needed to be in the car with all the cameras mounted on it. On the Rolls Royce as we raced around and got all these desert POVs. So I'm sitting in the back of this car and there's cameras on the side, all lashed together, and all the camera equipment. And we go around this corner and I hit the door handle with my elbow and the door opens. And the door didn't open all the way because we had all this bungee cord to hold the camera in place. But it opens and I'm leaning there, and all the camera equipment shoots across and practically knocks me out the door and comes back. That was like stupidity in first class. Why? I just felt I had to get the shots a certain way.
Wow.
Now you guys are all three of you guys started with Roger as editors, and you guys will all go on to direct your own movies. Roger always seemed to have this love of editors. And why do you think that is?
Control.
Yeah, he used to fire the director when they wrapped, often.
Very really?
Often. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
So that he could help with the edit, or?
He just wanted them out of the way. He might give them a cut, as I remember, and then they'd go. Yeah. But he liked editors. That's the best way I can describe it. He liked being in an editing room. He just liked being there. He spoke the language. It was, you know, he was with very enthusiastic kids, and he got something from it, I think.
Yeah, you're right. It's not unlike the system of a television series. You respect the director, you give them their cut and so forth, and then you wave them goodbye, and you do it so that's more in line with the style of the series.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was also a time where he could just talk film, you know. Yeah. He didn't have to worry about, you know, distribution or anything, or, you know, finances or budgets or scripts, and you could just talk, you know, film, you know.
And he would come
to the editing room first thing before he went into the office. So you would get him when he was in a good mood.
I was just going to ask a question, because being a great editor does not mean necessarily you're going to be a great director.
Right.
So what was his methodology for determining your editing skills have proved to me that you can be a great director? So I'm going to give you that chance.
Well, he never had to bother with that, because you had to go through extraordinary means to get him to give you the break. So is how often you had to plead with him. You know, with Joe and Alan, with John Davidson, they took Roger out and got him drunk.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so we started in March of 74. And so it's 50 years ago now.
Yeah.
And so we edited all through the summer, you know, and did all these pictures, and he really liked the trailers we did. I think that was Big Bad Mama and Death Race and a lot of stuff. And no matter what they threw at us, he ended up with a trailer that he really admired. And then he says at the end of the summer, "You boys have done a terrific job. I think you should take a vacation." And we're going, "Yeah." And he says, "I'll tell you what, come back in September and I'll rehire you."
Not a paid vacation, just a vacation.
And then he calls us up at the end of August and says, "You have to come in." And we go to Nossix, And he says, I just bought this picture and you have to cut the trailer over. It was Labor Day weekend because it's opening in New York in 2.5 weeks. And on comes Amarcord.
The Fellini film.
Yes. Yeah. And so it was the first sign, it was the second sign to Roger that the destinies were crossed. John and Joe had grown up on his movies. And I had studied the movies because of them. They had all copies. And that's what we would do. So we understood them, but he never had to say to us, this is Fellini. And we knew that. So we had a good talk about it. And we were frantically foaming at the mouth. The idea that you would have a print of a Fellini movie in your hands. Remember, there's no VHS, DVD. Mm-hmm. You're holding it. And you have all weekend with it. And he finally says, boys, calm down. <You know? laughs> Let's not forget, I know it's Fellini and he's a genius, but we're still selling sex and violence here. So I want the woman with the big breasts and the boys jerking off, and I want the cars going. So we cut the whole thing. And what happened was we couldn't cut it down to a length of like under 2 minutes. That's usually what the trailer was. It was hovering around 4. And the reason was that we could have taken the cheese ball way out and done cut, 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 cut of imagery, but we wanted to capture what was so special about this movie about memory and its unique sort of sense of the past and so forth. We didn't want to lose that. And so John Davison comes in on like Sunday night or, you know, and we've been up all weekend, and John looks and goes, it's too long. And so, well, here's the thing, John, when we shorten it, it doesn't work. And so he watched and he goes, oh, you're right. Well, we'll see what Roger says. So Roger comes in Tuesday morning and he says, how long is it? And we go, 4 minutes. And he goes, oh, you know, and then he watches it and he goes, it's really good. And he says, can we take anything out? Why can't you shorten it? And we talked to him about it, and he's a filmmaker. Yeah. You know what I mean? A normal head of the studio would say, forget all that, just cut it into quick cuts and get it in under 2 minutes. And he says, I see what you're saying. You know what? It's Fellini. Fuck him. Put it out at 4 minutes.
Wow.
And now the turning point in him recognizing me and Joe for what we could do.
From the maker of La Dolce Vita, 8.5, and Satyricon, comes a new masterwork. The new Fellini, Amarcord.
And so in 74 and 75, there was like one hit after Jackson County Jail and all this stuff, Eat My Dust. So it gets to the summer and we're thinking, we do not want to get laid off again, you know. And that's when we decided to beg him to let us do a movie, because he owned the equipment and the equipment was just sitting in a truck. And that was the basis of it. And the fact that Joe and I drove back and forth to every lab in Hollywood after working hours, because Roger was so cheap. And the labs, he drove such a hard deal. They would never let us color correct in the daytime. That was for the features. We would come in at night and work with the night crew, which is the people who did the vaults. And so we would go there at night and do that. And while we were driving around, we wrote all these scripts. There's one I have about a teacher's script with a teacher from Red China. I think they're called like Maoist school teachers or something. Anyway,
and did you get him drunk to try to see if he would let you make Hollywood Boulevard?
We knew what we wanted to do is basically not get laid off and then make a movie with the equipment. That was the goal. That was the ground zero. We could talk him into that. And then John drank a lot of wine with him and said, you know, Roger, the boys can make a movie with more action scenes than any other movie you've ever made. And it'll be cheaper than any movie you made this year. Now, that's a great
Yeah.
A huge sell. Yeah.
Yeah. How are you going to do that? Well, you know, they've seen every Corman, every movie you own the rights to. So we want to do what you did with Francis, which is we want to take footage from all these movies and shoot new scenes and come up with a plot of murders on the movie set so we can use death rays. And well, that immediately appeals to him. He says, so you'll be, how much time do you think you'll save? And he says, so 30 minutes of the film will already be shot. Exactly.
Well, also you had Candace Wilson.
Right.
In most of his movies.
And we want Candace. And so he said, okay, you got $65,000.
Wow. And,
but you can't stop editing trailers. That was the deal. And in the middle of shooting, in comes Truffaut's A Story of Adele H.
Mm-hmm.
And we had hired an assistant by the name of Amy Jones because she had been Scorsese's PA on Taxi Driver.
Mm-hmm.
Well, her husband shot it.
What?
Yeah.
Her husband shot it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so she sent us her documentary and we met her and we liked her. She's actually in Taxi Driver for like about a half a second. And so we gave her, you know, like anybody else, you want to do it, jump in, you know.
So well, she wound up doing the same thing that Roger had me do, which is to direct a 7-minute sequence that could go anywhere. And if you like the sequence, he would give us a whole movie. And so she did that with Sorority Massacre, whatever that's
Slumber called. Party Massacre.
Slumber, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, she took a script off the shelf, I believe. Tony, when you worked for Roger, you directed, but not until after, before New World, but after Roger had already sold the company. Did you ever approach him about directing?
No, because I was running New World or running his Millennium. And New World offered me a job to run their new, to replace somebody, but to run their post-production. So I remember walking into Roger and saying that I just got a call from New World. They want me to go over there and run post-production without missing a beat. He said, I can't pay you what they're going to pay you. Good luck.
Wow.
That was it. There was no, you know, but looking back over the years, I think he just saw that as the way it went with these kids, you know.
Yeah.
They move on. He wasn't attached to anybody. So, and yeah.
Yeah, we were, well, we had to, I remember walking with John and Joe from the office when it was on Sunset, right near where Tower Records used to be.
Yeah, yep,
yep.
It's right near Sunset in La Cienega.
Yeah, not too far from there, right where it, and so we were walking there, we were talking about the outrageous amount of money that movies cost. I mean, they were making movies, guys, for $6.5 million. And so we're saying, I'm glad ours only cost $65,000. And Roger watched the first cut and he was pretty surprised.
Yeah. You know?
He did not think it would be as clever and that the footage would be as integrated as it was. And he really liked it. And then he asked for another cut. And he gave us notes, and then we come back, and he goes, he says, what happened with the scene with the producer? We had improvised a scene where the producer says, I'm doing really well. See this shirt? $100. And we had cut it out. And Roger says, where's the scene about the shirt? And he'd only seen it once. And we said, oh, he cut out, doesn't come, push me. Oh, it's good for his character. I mean, he's a good producer. Why shouldn't he? And so flash forward 50 years, 45 years. And right here in this room, we have downstairs, we have a rock and roll high school pizza party with some of the crew and Roger. Okay. So they all come up here and we run some trailers and stuff and scenes, and we're just laughing our asses off on it and telling stories. And so we run the sequence from Hollywood Boulevard, which is all the women in prison movies and bombs going off, and the women are firing machine guns, and it's all cut to Ride of the Valkyries and Mary. And we're watching it, and when it's over, Roger turns to me and says, "Very well cut, Alan." Just, I was still a Gnostic with him. I got such a chill.
Wow.
So the thing about his studio, his it was like an apartment building on Sunset. I think there were three levels, but he had a rooftop,
right?
And that's where you did all the inserts for all the movies at night. You just shoot low angles there, and so wherever the scene took place, that's where you shot inserts.
Yeah, up on the roof, right?
And so the final
with all the movies there. I think it's really important, whether it was a nurse movie, a teacher movie, a prison movie, there are always three stories that you could follow. And from an editing point of view, as soon as one got boring, you could cut to the other. So it was structuring a film through parallel editing, which was an ingenious idea.
Yeah. And it really helped me when I made the transition to episodic television. Because when I started doing shows like Fame and certainly St. Elsewhere, where you had three or four plots going at the same time, it seemed very natural to me. It was not a problem.
Hmm. Now, Roger's career obviously went over like nearly 70 years.
Yeah.
A massive career. And so he's been talked about a lot. But what do you guys think that people get right about Roger Corman? And what do you think people get wrong about Roger Corman that you hear, you know, in popular culture? Alan Holzman, do you want to start us off?
Thanks. Well, every time, just now, reading about what people are writing about him, everyone gets it right.
Yeah.
He's just done so much and the stories are just so bad that whatever you say about him is true. You know, and sometimes, you know, I mean, what people really don't quite understand is how charming he really was. And just so well mannered, but he had a way of feigning social awkwardness, or maybe it was true. But he would always say goodbye quickly, and you could never feel like you're always under time pressure with him, and that was his defensive mechanism. And when you had to talk to him on the phone, there was always someone, you know, to talk to him before you get to him. And then he always got zeroed in on what it was. So there was never any small talk. But he was, you know, handsome, tall, thin, smiling, you know, as nice as can be, but he could also be so vicious and heartless. And like you just couldn't understand how mean he could be at times. I mean, it's like, as soon as you did something good, he would take something away. I remember in battle, as soon as he liked the first cut, there goes the second editor, there goes the second moviola, there goes the phone. I mean, at one point he took out the water machine. So I had to write him a letter of how long it took us to go over to the main studio to get water and come back, and how that was a waste of time. So he put back the sparkling bottle. I mean, the thing you said more than anything else was, "But Roger," you know?
Right, right.
Tony,
great. I mean, there's no one like him, you know. I mean, he gave people their breaks, you know. He also gave people who screwed up in their careers breaks. So he helped people on their way up and the way down, and he had to pay them the same thing, you know.
Yeah, Bogdanovich did St. Jack for us, you know.
Yeah
terrific movie.
Yeah
what do you, Alan, what do you think that people get wrong about Roger?
They don't realize how erudite he was and how sophisticated he was. People have this image and they're thinking really of Sam Arkoff. You know what I mean?
Right.
The heavyset guy with the cigar.
Yeah.
And that was not Roger. Roger had a really incisive intelligence. And the things that made him go to engineering school at Stanford were the analytical mind that he approached production with. But somewhere else in his brain was the artist.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was what you dealt with. So people don't know that side of him and how funny he was.
Oh, he also studied literature at Oxford.
And so he was really smart. And last year sometime, I started thinking about him and Chuck Griffith together. And I got to know Chuck because he had done Eat My Dust, and we had put him in Hollywood Boulevard and everything. And Chuck kind of adopted me and Joe and everyone from the editing room. And he would invite us over to his house, and he'd make a big bowl of curry or chili. And he would just be funny Chuck, you know?
Yeah.
And him and Roger together, you could see why there was chemistry. I actually did a trailer from Hell about the two of them and my relationship to the two of them. It's for Attack of the Crab Monsters.
Okay. You know? Okay.
And there's a lot of great quotes that they gave about the making of that movie, you know, and the fact that Roger would let someone as wacky as Chuck, you know,
yeah,
and appreciate what Chuck brought to it. And so he understood talent. And I got to say that over the years, I became friendlier and friendlier with Roger. And so Joe and I would always make an effort to have dinner with him and invite him to, I mean, he came to a bunch of screenings of Rock and Roll High School. And the last time we had him over for dinner in the summer. And last time I saw him, I guess, was in October or November at the Aero.
Mm.
Right. And that's right. There was like a retrospective, right?
Yeah. And so they ran The Raven, Grand Theft Auto, Rock and Roll High School, something else, Piranha. Uh-huh. And afterwards, it was me and Ron Howard and Joe and Amy Jones and everyone sitting up there. And the moderator was really good. God, I can't remember his name at the moment, but he was very, he's a real film buff. He's one of the Trailer from Hell gurus.
Okay. And
was it
Larry Karaszewski or no?
No, it wasn't Larry.
Okay.
He directs a lot of TV movies from Stephen King books.
Oh, Mick Garris.
That's it. And so Mick really conducted this, and the audience, nobody left. I mean, it was like we all gave each other room and filled in all the anecdotes, and it went on for like an hour and a half. And it was so much fun. Mm. We all went over to Roger's house, had a lot of vodka and martinis, and had the best time.
Wow.
John Davison was there, you know, and Ron and stuff. So it was really fun, you know. It was really
fun. I have a funny story about Roger's house in Mandeville Canyon. Yeah. I arrived a day early at a party for Sergio Santiago, who is his Filipino director, who he distributed many movies for.
Yeah.
And so and I noticed that everything in his house was yellow and white. This is when Roger and Julie's kids were young. They had all these abstract paintings of just yellow and white, and furniture, carpeting, yellow and white, you know. And they said that they found out that, and their kids were going to UCLA when they were really, really young for this advanced educational thing. And they said they found out that the colors yellow and white made kids happy. but he didn't buy the paintings. He had his art directors imitate the paintings, and that's what hung on his wall.
Yeah, huh. Go ahead and paint my house yellow and white starting tomorrow.
Other thing, now John Davison went over there, and Roger turned on this device when he put the kids to bed. It was the sound of heartbeat,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
Boom, boom. And John says, "What is that?" He says, "It's the sound of a heartbeat, and it calms the children." And John says, "Does it work?" He says, "No, but it drowns out the crying." Now that's a Roger joke. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's
good. Yeah.
That is.
I just want to say one quick thing about
yes, please.
Tony, because Tony really represents what working for Roger was really like, because he started out as an assistant in the special effects department.
Yeah.
And he started in the mailroom, right? I mean,
well, his first break in terms of, you know, how I met him. And as the editor, you know, you look to who can be your partner or you can trust or whose opinion you like. And Tony was that. And I could find out everything that was going on with the special effects department through him. And I could understand, you know, how to proceed. And he was very giving, and he was able to manage, you know, both, you know, whatever argument there was. He had a calm demeanor, but a devotion to working. And hour after hour, no matter what it was, he showed his love of film through, you know, through the smallest detail in trying to keep everything organized. And with film, you have to be really organized, because if the codes don't match to the negative, you're really screwed. And with, so it was just a lot. So and Tony was able to rise, you know, all through the system that way, you know.
Thank you, Alan. That's kind of you. Well, I think that a lot of that was, you know, if you go back to Roger, you kind of, not so much you didn't want to screw up, but you wanted an acceptance of, like a parent, because he was like a parent.
Yes.
To a lot of kids. And you wanted the acceptance that you were doing a good job. And he would give it in his way. And going back to Ryan's question about what they get right, what they get wrong. My very first day working in the mailroom, part of that job, it wasn't sorting mail at all. It was really driving around, delivering scripts and going to the editing room on El Centro and doing all these runs. And I walked into the editing room in El Centro, and it was a little bit chaotic. This is after Joe and Alan were gone, but because this was 1979. But there were stills on the walls from the various films that he distributed with bubbles written of dialogue. And a lot of it was derogatory about the film. And it was derogatory about Roger. And I've remembered that all these years, because this very distinguished man, and I know because I saw him do it, would walk in and look at these stills and read them. And it was a little insulting. He would never react. He accepted it. And I think he really liked it, because talking about Roger's personality, he was very dignified and very, 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 very reserved. Everybody will tell you the same thing. But I think he got that side of him out, being around crazy.
Yeah.
And working at New World, you were around a lot of crazy, but it was a very fun crazy. It was fun. It was an exciting place, and everybody was really into being there. And he created this amazing environment, a creative environment to work. And I think people do actually. I don't know whether they understand that part of it, but he created this environment. It was his genius, was really this, to create an environment of kids just out of school who were going to kill themselves, work all-nighters, whatever it took to get the best thing possible, which was never looked at as very good because it was exploitation. But it didn't matter. It didn't matter. We were going to do the best with what we could.
You know, Tony, I got to say that you totally nailed it there. You know, that really was it. And now that I'm teaching at the AFI, I kind of know what Roger was up to, because here was a filmmaker who loved film. He really loved film. And the idea that you could pass on knowledge and that knowledge would be used, and that you would listen to what the younger generation would say and enjoy their movies, is what I'm experiencing now with filmmakers at the AFI or in their 20s and so forth. And it's invigorating, you know? And like you say, we made those movies and we got invited to the Locarno Film Festival in 2000. And they were doing a week of movies of they called us the Corman class of the 70s. And we show up and they take us to the center of the town, and there's like 3,000 chairs set up. and on the stage, and all these people are cheering us, and they run a reel of our trailers. It's like, what? And you know, they ran the Temptations, they ran Rock and Roll High School, they ran the Movie Orgy, Piranha, you know, and it was like, I get, you know, it's like, we just did it.
But it wasn't that way when it actually happened, because I was a student at AFI when I started with Candy Stripe Nurses and also Crazy Mama, because I cut each one during the spring of each year. And people at AFI thought that the Corman people were just trash, like knew nothing about, because they were all going to make the great Hollywood movies. And everyone working for Corman thought the AFI people were just a bunch of jerks and knew nothing about film.
Yeah, so now, you know, just 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, I did a little thing where it was Roger's birthday. And so I always put a film clip at the end of my production class. And so I showed them the clip from The Wild Angels, where Peter Fonda gives that speech at the funeral. We want to get high. We want to be free. Mm-hmm. And they all just like ate it up. And then when he passed away, I did a tribute to him this week and ran part of that terrific documentary. You know,
yeah.
Carmen's World. Yes.
But it was also interesting how oratory was often a part of his movies. There was often someone who was so devoted, you'd get some section where there was someone passionately talking about life and what it meant, you know.
Well, we want to be free. We want to be free to do what we want to do. We want to be free to ride. And we want to be free to ride our machines without being hassled by the man. And we want to get loaded. And we want to have a good time. That's what we're gonna do.
Away, baby, let's go.
We're gonna have a good time. Oh. We're gonna have a party. Yeah!
Many thanks to Alan Arkish, Alan Holzman, and Tony Randall. Thank you so much for coming on the episode. We hope you enjoyed this. Roger Corman, we salute you. Thank you so much. 98 years, a terrific career, and we're indebted to you. Not just for this podcast, but throughout cinema. Thank you so much, Roger.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast. Bye, everybody.